Chapter 10. Rebecca Oleska, having lost her quarry on that damp Dublin morning, returned to the Gresham Hotel and the man with the dark brown voice, who was now there in person, tall, muscular, and handsome as his speech, though he did not speak this time. Instead, he stood next to her in the elevator and produced a small leather notepad with the paper clipped neatly into brass-edged slots. On the top sheet, he had written, "Please accompany me into the street. This is an official instruction from Detective Superintendent Elizabeth Lydiard." Bex gave him a cheeky smile, pressed the button for the ground floor, and nodded cheerfully. Out on the pavement, in the wet again, he extended a large black umbrella and bent his body at the waist while sheltering her from the rain. "A turn around the block, I think." The voice matched, deep colonial brown and lovely, with the resonance of an echo chamber. "What's going on?" Bex asked, concentrating on trying to remain relatively dry. "Apart from you losing sight of Beecher." His eyebrows lifted in a classic "I'm one hell of a wag" look. "If you know that, then you probably know where she's gone, which makes me redundant." "Far from it." They reached the corner, and he put out one hand, touching her arm to signify that they should turn right. "It'd be best just to give you the message, as it was passed on to me. Miss Lydiard says, would you please not lose her this time? Beecher, that is. If you do, she'll request your transfer to directing traffic." He switched his nice smile on and off. "Not quite in those words, sir."
"I can imagine."
"Good. We more or less know her direction, up to a point anyway. How's your German and Italian?"
"Nicht hinauslehen. Pericoloso di morte."
"Brilliant. I've got tickets for you. You'll be on the same flight as the lady, leaving from Dublin this afternoon, going to Bern, changing at Brussels."
"Where the sprouts come from."
"Oh, indeed, yes. The tricky bit'll be Bern. That's the part we don't know about. She's got an open ticket that'll take her on from Bern. That's it. We don't know any more."
"Broken our crystal ball, have we?"
"No crystal balls, no Ouija boards, not even a pack of tarots. Just the passkey and enough mechanics to do a swift search while we put ears on the telephone. She had the tickets hiding in plain sight. Obviously kept an appointment this morning and expects to move on to Bern this afternoon. I imagine she plans an overnight there and on to wherever in the morning. I think it's probably quite important for you to be on her back all the way. I'd make that a fairly high priority if you don't like the thought of waving at cars and buses."
"What if the tickets are a plant? What if they're to throw watches off the scent?"
"They're not. While you were busy losing her, London ran a check on airline computers, and she's done the trip before, regularly, each time within a month of some spectacular."
"You're saying that from here she goes on to meet Alchemist?"
"Quite possibly. That's what the glamour boys think, and if they're right, he lives somewhere south of Bern."
"No educated guess?"
"Could be anywhere. Miss Lydiard thinks you should let usual surveillance go hang. Just be someone travelling in the same direction. Don't try to hide. Just be there."
"She'd know, of course. And we all thought the old tradcraft and stuff was a thing of the past."
"Nothing's ever wasted."
"What if I do turn up someone else?"
"You give us a shout. Well, not me, but London."
She looked at him as the rain trickled down the ribs of his saturated umbrella. "Who are you working for?"
"Commander Bane, as far as you're concerned."
"Funny. Never met you before, if you're OS-13.
"Oh, come on, Rebecca. This is illegal as hell. Nobody's counting, and Joe Bane will get the collar if you run Alchemist to Earth."
"What kind of backup do I have?"
"You're deniable. But we've got guardian angels out in the field. If it gets hairy, someone will rope you in. They've been close all day, but I doubt if even you could spot them. We're not going to let you come to any harm."
"Promise?"
She opened her eyes wide in what Charlie called her doe-like bimbo mode. "Absolutely." He flashed his teeth in a Colgate grin, insincere as a tart's declaration of love, white against his coffee-coloured skin. They were back in O'Connell Street before he handed her the Amex wallet containing her airline and Swiss Rail tickets. Outside the Gresham, he touched her shoulder lightly and wished her luck. So
So she took a cab up to Grafton Street and went straight to the now amalgamated Brown, Thomas and Switzers, the old established Dublin department stores, and equipped herself with the accessories of disguise. A reversible raincoat, two soft, crushable hats, three scarves, including one expensive Hermès, and a pair of heavy-framed, clear spectacles that she lifted from a display stand, fully cognizant that she was breaking all rules of tradecraft. On her way out, she bought a slightly larger garment bag with a waterproof zippered compartment that would take the new reversible raincoat and other items, as well as war paint and the bits and pieces necessary to sustain life for a modern executive woman. Most of the things she bought were for emergency use only, if she needed to use the simplest of disguises. She did not look twice at the tall, slim man wearing a trench coat and a cloth cap set at a jaunty angle. He saw her, though, saw her, and was latched onto her the whole time. God was in her heaven, and Bex had a guardian angel. Back at the hotel, she rang the contact number of the OS-13 office at the Yard, and was told that, yes, Joe Bain had okayed the operation, though not in so many words. What was actually said was that her car repairs should be completed by the end of next week. All very le carré, really. The girl fielding calls for Bain told her they'd been on to the factory, and the part they required was on its way. "There's no need to worry, Mrs. Nightingale. Your insurance is going to cover everything." Well, that was nice, she thought. Very secure, that made you feel. It took her only 10 minutes to pack the garment bag and explain to reception that she had to check out unexpectedly, and to ask them to keep her overnight case. She paid the bill, then took a taxi, which dropped her off at Dublin International a good 2 hours before the flight was due to leave for Brussels. A helpful check-in girl told her she could get away with taking the garment bag onto the aircraft as hand baggage. The flight wasn't full, and yes, they would be on time. Bex went through to the restaurant on the ground side and treated herself to a wholly inappropriate meal of sausages and fries with bread and butter and a cup of strong tea, twice, to blazes with the cholesterol and calories. As she ate, Bex suddenly realized that she missed her new husband very much. She wanted to call him but could not because heaven knew who was watching. Nowadays, they did not even have to see you dialing a number to get it. A brand-new little electronic gizmo could pick up the number from 100 meters away. She'd had it demoed at a recent high-tech weekend. "The old spy cult has a great deal to answer for," she said to the techie, who muttered something about fact being stranger than friction. "You mean fiction?" He gave her a supercilious little smirk. "I know what I mean," she said, and the techie gave her a sour look. Replete, she headed through to the air side, showing her Nightingale passport. At the gate she found a seat giving her an uninterrupted view, and began to watch for the arrival of Tessa Murray. There was one Garda special branch man, looking every inch a cop, sprawled in a seat nearby, sticking out like the proverbial spare what's-it at the nuptials. Later an entire team turned up, two men and a woman, young, playful, and action-mannish. Though Bex could not have said for sure whose side they were on. They could easily have been security service on an away day, or equally, Tessa's own people keeping an eye on their asset. Again, she wondered what the hell Charlie was up to in Scotland. If that was indeed where he was. Couldn't be much of a sweat, after all he was retired. When they called the flight bang on time, Tessa had not even shown. In fact, Bex was ready to offload herself when Murray turned up, almost the last aboard. What was the old TV ad? Murray mince, too good to hurry mince. As it was, Bex had to look twice. The woman she had followed that morning looked early middle-aged, slightly dowdy, and would not have turned many heads. The Tessa who now arrived looked sleek and svelte, trim in a claret pantsuit with denim blue accessories. That would have looked really nice in the 80s, Bex thought. Tessa's long black hair trailed onto one shoulder, giving her a hint of the gypsy, complemented by the large dark eyes and heavily beringed fingers. Somehow the look did not go with the briefcase and overnight bag, which could easily have been by Gucci. For the first time, Bex was able to study Tessa with a pinch of envy. In another time, they could have been friends. Certainly, Tessa seemed to have the élan and poise that made the new Mrs. Gauntlet feel the prick of covetousness.